A tiny bird kept showing up, so I followed by Vasco Gaspar. There is a Portuguese philosopher named Agostinho da Silva, who once said something I carry with me everywhere. Don't make plans for life, because you might spoil the plans that life has for you. I didn't understand this when I first heard it. I was the kind of person who needed plans, explanations, spreadsheets, but life, it turns out, had been waiting for me to put down the clipboard. Completely lost. I grew up in a rural part of Portugal, in the middle of nowhere. My grandparents worked close to the land, humble, rooted people. Nothing in my childhood suggested I would one day be traveling the world, speaking in English, teaching meditation to executives. That was not in the plan at all. As a teenager, I was completely lost. I played in bands, dreamed of being a singer, and mostly coped with my anxiety and confusion through smoking and drinking. Everything felt like drama, especially relationships. At one point, the suffering my mind was generating felt unbearable. I even considered ending my life. Then one day, I ran into someone, Diogo, a friend of my brother's I hadn't seen in years. We'd both arrived early to meet our separate groups of friends, so we stood there talking. And he was glowing, radiant smile, shiny eyes, something alive in him that I couldn't name. I asked him what happened. He told me he'd read a book called The Celestine Prophecy, something about synchronicities and energy. I wanted that glow. I bought the book that same day. Something in me was awakened, the possibility that there might be a purpose, that life was more than smoking cigarettes and waiting for time to pass. But I was 19. I had no teacher, no practice. After 3 months of hugging trees and confusing my friends, the spark faded, and I went back to just getting by. The suit and the sadness. I finished my psychology studies, put on a tie, and became a corporate consultant. Society told me I'd found my place. I wore the suit, I carried the briefcase. And inside, I was 20 kilograms heavier, smoking 40 cigarettes a day, and completely hollow. What am I doing here? One day, I took a day off from work and decided to play a game with life. Instead of planning, I would just walk, go left or right based on whatever my body felt. This was wildly unlike me. I was very rational, scientific, the kind of person who needs an explanation for everything. But I took off my tie and wandered. I entered a magazine shop, closed my eyes, and grabbed the first thing my hand touched. It was a magazine about the science of happiness, the last thing I would have normally picked up. Inside, I discovered Mathieu Ricard, the Buddhist monk considered the happiest man on earth, and the fact that science was actually studying happiness. I became obsessed. I read everything: positive psychology, neuroscience, philosophy, contemplative traditions, notebooks full of connections. Two books especially moved me: Eckhart Tolle's A New Earth and Otto Scharmer's Theory U. Both pointed to the same mystery from different directions. What is life wanting to live through you? Can we sense the future and lead from there? Something deep in me resonated. Do you really want to meditate? I tried everything: workshops, groups, practices. Something was always missing. Then I found myself sitting with a red-haired healer in her 60s, a woman who had lived in India in the 1980s. I told her I was drawn to meditation, but nothing quite fit. She looked at me with something shining in her eyes and asked simply, "Do you really want to meditate?" A part of me thought, "I already know meditation." But a deeper part said yes. She introduced me to heartfulness meditation. The instruction was almost absurdly simple: sit, focus on the divine light in your heart. My mind spun. What color is the light? Why am I here? But when she said, "That's all," after what I thought were a few minutes, 45 minutes had passed. This happened on the second day too. On the third day, I didn't try to see the light. I didn't try to relax or feel anything. I just waited. And in that waiting, something inside me was touched. I didn't see the light. But I felt, from within, something telling me, "This is it. This is what you've been looking for all these years." That was the 3rd of June, 2009. From that moment, I started to follow my heart. What happens when you follow the heart? Within weeks, something appeared during morning meditation, an image, a design for a tool. I didn't invent it so much as receive it. It became a 90-day well-being diary I called Zorbuda. My mind said, sell it. But every time I moved toward putting a price on it, my whole body contracted. It was so loud, a clear signal that this was meant to be a gift. So I gave it away, free, online, to anyone who wanted it. I quit my corporate job. I had 10,000 euros in my bank account and no income. My boss was unhappy. My parents thought I'd lost it. My friends were certain. The only person who stood beside me was my wife. Maybe she thought I was crazy too, but she was there. Following the heart then led me to the world of mindfulness and to a conference where a Google engineer named Chade Meng Tan shared a program called Search Inside Yourself, a mindfulness-based emotional intelligence protocol. It was everything I'd been working toward, wrapped in a beautiful structure. I became one of those people who carries the book under their arm everywhere, trying to tell everyone about it. 50,000 euros and a ringing phone. Here's where the dates matter. In May 2012, I gave a guest lecture at a university because a professor named Helena, who'd been touched that I gave Zorbuda away for free, asked me to fill in while she picked up a teacher at the airport. She told me, speak about your dreams. So I talked about Zorbuda and Search Inside Yourself, and I even dared to bring my guitar and end by singing. Something moved through me that day that I can't fully explain. Afterward, a French woman named Anne-Sophie approached me. She'd been a CEO, then became a mindfulness teacher, and had never heard of a protocol designed for companies. We exchanged business cards. I put hers in a drawer, as I did with all business cards at the time, and forgot about it. Months later, Search Inside Yourself became an independent institute. They announced the first public program in San Francisco. I wanted to go more than I'd wanted anything in a long time. Every cell in my body said yes, but it was far beyond what I could afford. I took a deep breath and thought, maybe one day. And I let it go. Then, out of nowhere, an email. Anne-Sophie. I had genuinely forgotten about our encounter. She wrote that she had just returned from San Francisco. She had attended the very program I couldn't afford, and while she was there, she had thought of me. She had also learned that a window was opening. Trainers would be in Barcelona for a private client in July, and if we organized something in Lisbon the week before or after, we could split costs and bring them here. I couldn't believe it. We gathered 20 people in a cafe in Lisbon to test the idea. By the end of the meeting, only three of us still believed. Anne-Sophie, Elaine, and me. The rest had reasons. Portugal wasn't ready. The price was too high. We were diluting ancient teachings. They didn't believe in us. The three of us kept going. Small workshops, borrowed spaces, building interest one person at a time. Meanwhile, my bank account was draining. A little over 2,000 euros left, and 384 euros invoiced in 3 months. Then my friend Miguel called with a corporate opportunity. Design a keynote to inspire beer sellers. Deliver it several times over a month. Receive 50,000 euros, 5 times my yearly income as a freelancer. And I only had 2,000 euros left in my bank account. Every cell in my body went into alarm. My mind didn't understand. My heart raced. My hands sweated. I asked him for a moment, hung up, and did a search inside myself, literally. The contraction was unmistakable. It wasn't aligned with my values on many levels. And it would conflict with organizing the Search Inside Yourself program, which was my dream. So I called Miguel back and said no. He called me an idealist. He was probably right. 2 days later, our team realized we couldn't organize the program in Portugal either. No dream, no money. 2 days after that, the phone rang. It was Anne-Sophie, a friend of hers in Barcelona. The very person organizing Search Inside Yourself's European program had invited her, and she could bring a guest. Not only did I attend that program, my fulfilled dream, but months later, when they opened 30 spots for the world's first cohort of Search Inside Yourself teachers, every single criterion they asked for was something I had gathered since the moment I quit my job and stepped into the unknown. The flight of the hummingbird. There's a reason I call this the path of the hummingbird. Every time I've stepped into a synchronicity, every moment where life's plan revealed itself, a hummingbird appeared. The first time I went to San Francisco, One hovered right in front of my face at Lafayette Park. When I visited a museum in Madrid, agonizing over whether to commit to a new training path I couldn't afford, I spotted a tiny painting from across the room. When I reached it, there was a hummingbird. I turned to my teacher and said, "Count me in." In Oxford, I was the only person with a hummingbird ornament on my bedside table. At an airport leaving India, I randomly opened a magazine, Hummingbird, at a retreat in India. Just after I'd spoken to the group about synchronicities and hummingbirds, a sunbird appeared at the window, tapping on the glass, trying to get in. Another time, after a similar talk, a volunteer ran up to me wide-eyed. That morning, he'd felt a strange impulse to bring me a bottle of sesame oil from his farm, almost left it behind, didn't know why. The brand on the label was a hummingbird. He knew nothing about my hummingbird stories. I've stopped counting after 200. Even on a flight home from Ireland last September, the stranger sitting next to me, same sneakers, same brand, same quiet presence, was wearing a shirt with a hummingbird on it. I only noticed at passport control. Like a guardian angel, sitting right beside me the whole time. The carpet in the dark. People sometimes ask me how I know the difference between the heart's whisper and the ego's noise. I'll be honest, sometimes I don't. But I've learned to pay attention to two things. The first is contraction. My spiritual teacher says, the heart usually only speaks loudly when you're doing something wrong, the way you only notice your liver when there's a problem. Every time I was about to put a price on something meant to be a gift, or say yes to something out of alignment, my body would contract. That signal became a red light I learned not to ignore. The second is inspiration. The word comes from inspiritus, to be aligned with spirit. There's an image from a Dan Brown novel that stays with me. A man running through a completely dark hangar, chasing the only exits. The sole cue he has is a thin carpet beneath his feet. When he strays off it, he knows he's lost the path. For me, inspiration is that carpet. When I feel it, I follow. When I lose it, I fumble in the dark, praying, until I feel it under my feet again. And the hummingbirds? They're the signposts along the road. They come as if to say, you're on the right track, keep going. I still get lost, by the way. I got lost this morning. The difference is that now I'm okay with being lost. I pray. I wait. I trust that there's something larger holding all of this. Holding me, holding you, holding life. Einstein is said to have called this the most important question we can ask. Is the universe a friendly place? If you decide it is, then even a wrong step becomes part of the path. And if the path is linear, it's probably not yours. You're following someone else's. So I keep walking, sometimes stumbling, sometimes singing, sometimes just waiting in the dark with my eyes closed and my hand over my heart until a tiny bird appears, hovering there, as if to say, yes, this way.